Hello, this is your volunteer broadcaster, Ben, bringing you this week's Sports Illustrated broadcast. In today's program, we'll be covering some different articles on different athletes, including Connor McDavid and Caitlin Clark. We'll also be covering some essays, including The Sky's the Limit, a pesky FCS conference is surviving and thriving as it navigates college football's new landscape. All of this and more in today's program. Please enjoy. We're going to start off with some athlete articles, the first being Connor McDavid by Kristen Nelson. The NHL offseason was dominated by chatter about the future of Oilers captain, with some wondering when he will sign a contract extension with Edmonton, his current deal is set to expire at the end of the season, or if he should consider moving to a bigger market. However, he resolves his contract situation. His new deal is but one of the items on the plate for a 28-year-old NHL superstar, who is perhaps one of the most important people in Canada. A year after scoring overtime winner for Team Canada in the championship game of the four national face-off in February, McDavid is set to be one of the stars in 2026. Milano Cortina Games, which will be the first Olympics in 12 years with NHL players participating. And then there's the matter of the 2025-26 season. McDavid, who had at least 100 points for the eighth time in his 10-year career last season, will continue on his quest to win Edmonton its first title since the days of Wayne Gretzky. The center has long been touted as one of the fastest skaters in the league, and when he combines that speed with his silky smooth stick handling, you get ankle-breaking moments like in Game 2 of last season's Stanley Cup Final. Controlling the puck near the blue line of the Oilers' offensive zone, McDavid deked past one Florida player, toe-dragged around another, and sent a perfect cross-ice pass to line mate Leon Draisaitl to score a one-timer. It was a highlight that social media had to slow down just to see how immaculate it was. McDavid and Draisaitl make up one of the strongest cores in the league, but it was McDavid who single-handedly dragged his team to Game 7 of the 2024 Stanley Cup Final and again set the tone at the start of the 2025 Final. Those championship appearances both ended in losses to the Panthers, but the Oilers' window of contention is still wide open and should stay that way as long as McDavid is in town. Our next athlete article is on Caitlin Clark. Absence can sometimes be the most powerful measure of presence, and that axiom becomes apparent when looking at what happens when the WNBA's 2024 Rookie of the Year is not on the court. All-Star Game viewership this year dropped 36% compared to last summer with the Fever guard sidelined due to a groin injury. And last season, home teams tended to draw about 5,000 fewer fans in games Clark missed. When she's on the court, though, it's showtime, because Indiana's attack becomes among the league's best when it comes to pace and offensive rating. The Fever's title hopes, as well as their three-year turnaround from the 11th in attendance, 4,066, to second, 16,790 as of August 15th in 25, rest on her shoulders. Our next article is on college football star Jeremiah Smith. Ask virtually any scout who the best player in college football is, and this Buckeye is the first name they will mention. Smith could have challenged the NFL's draft rules after last season. He's not eligible until 2027, but opted not to, despite setting freshman FBS records for receiving yards, 1,315, and TDs, 15, for national championship Ohio State. But with the earning opportunities he has already, what's the rush to go pro anyway? Smith makes seven figures in NIL deals, with Adidas, Nintendo, and Red Bull among his endorsements. This sophomore, who turns 20 on November 29th, should have two more seasons to show just how enriching today's college experience can be. Our next athlete article is on Faith Kipyegon. Her goal is to become the first woman to break the 4-minute mile. She is already the only woman to run the distance in under 4 minutes and 10 seconds. She's done it twice. Or complete the 1500 meter in under 3 minutes and 50 seconds, 3 times. And she reset the world records in each event in June and July. In support of her headline mission, Nike mustered its scientists to create its most aerodynamic speed suit ever, as well as a sports bra optimized for moisture management and also much lighter spikes. Kipyegon sets the pace and everyone else follows. Our next athlete's article is on two tennis players, Jannik Sinner and Carlos Alcaraz. The retirements of Roger Federer and Rafael Nadal were supposed to set off a down period for men's tennis, but suddenly, their great rivalry has a rival. Here comes Sinner by way of Italy, and Alcaraz, Spain. ages 24 and 22 respectively. Through this year's Wimbledon, Tsitsipas has won each of the last seven major singles titles. Federer and Nadal once won 11 majors in a row between them. There's no personal friction here, but enough contrast of style and personality to make this a successful successorship. Our next athlete article is on female UFC star Kayla Harrison by L. John Wertheim. There are a welter of combat sports stars who failed to transition over and make it big in the UFC. And in the opposite corner, Harrison. After winning Olympic gold in judo in 2012 and 16, the 35-year-old is now among the brightest stars in the UFC cosmos. And if the bantamweight champ call-out of heretofore GOAT Amanda Nunes is accepted, it might make for the biggest female mega fight in UFC history. Our next athlete article is on Lamine Yamal. After making his pro debut for Barcelona in 2023, the talented teenage winger has been dazzling teammates and opponents alike across Europe. Up next, the chance at bringing the World Cup back to Spain by Gray Whitebloom. In the build-up to the 2025 Champions League final, six Inter Milan players were asked to name their toughest opponents of the season. All six, spread across the pitch from goalkeeper to striker, chose the same teenage luminary, Lamine Yamal. Barcelona's 18-year-old scamp has established himself as one of the world's most feared footballers with a unique blend of youthful exuberance and innate maturity. Beyond the audacious flicks, dizzying dribbles, and signature swats at goal, it is Yamal's staggering ability to choose the right weapon with which to torment his opponents that stands out the most. Lamine's decision-making is almost always correct, which is surprising for someone so young, Yamal's first senior manager, Xavi Hernandez, said shortly after the player became the youngest in Barcelona's history at the age of 15. By that point, Yamal had already been a member of Barcelona's various youth teams for more than half his short life, joining the Catalan giants based along the coast from his treasured neighborhood of Rocafonda in Matara when he was just 7. Most of the record-toppling number of goals that he scores are celebrated with a special jangle of fingers spelling out the number 304. The proud native of an increasingly scrutinized slice of Matara came up with this nod to the area's postcode while sitting in his cousin's car at the start of 2022. Despite going to school and playing for the local team where his mother lived in La Torreta, Yamal clearly valued the time spent out on the coast, tiptoeing around the concrete courts of Rocafonda with any number of his 23 cousins. He didn't just play with his family members in Rocafonda. Training also included dribbling against the various dogs that roamed around the humble neighborhood. Those unorthodox practice partners were shared by another player who bamboozled defenders in Barcelona colors. Much like Yamal, stopping Ronaldinho was trying to pin a wave to the sand. The Brazilian has previously lauded the time he spent scurrying around the streets with his pet dog, Bom Bom. When you're playing in Europe, Ronaldinho grinned, a few defenders will remind you of Bom Bom. Yamal goes after humans too. He took on the fullback lining up against him 316 times during the 2024-25 campaign in La Liga alone. No one else across Europe's top five league did it more than 208 times. Across the two legs of Barcelona's Championship League semifinal, Yamal wriggled toward the Italian outfit's backline 38 times. His opposite winger, Rafinha, a leading candidate for this year's Ballon d'Or, along with Yamal, attempted 37 dribbles across the entire European campaign. It's no wonder all those inner players singled out Yamal. Despite the teenager's best efforts, Barcelona's quest for continental glory ended against Inter in the Championship League semis in May. Hansi Flick's free-scoring outfit managed to scoop up every domestic prize on offer, La Liga, Copa del Rey, and Spanish Super Cup, thumping arch-rivals Real Madrid on the way to each leg of Treble Yamal, who has scored 3 times in 7 El Clasico appearances, took great pleasure in reminding Madrid of their place in Spain's hierarchy. If we concede a goal, no problem, he shrugged after Barcelona's 3-2 win over Real Madrid in Copa del Rey final. If we concede 2 goals, no problem, because this year's they can't beat us. It would be easy for a young player who has enjoyed even a fraction of Yamal's success to develop a cocky veneer. but most who have come into contact with the global star go to great pains to hell his humanity. Yamal was first called up to a senior Barcelona training session at 15. Robert Lewandowski has only arrived in Catalonia from Bayern Munich a few months earlier. After the round of practice, the veteran center forward came away awestruck. "I had never seen a player like that in my life," said Lewandowski, who has already been crowned top scorer of Poland's third division when Yamal was born. Over the subsequent years, spent gobbling up the slew of outrageously arched crosses bursting off the outside of Yamal's left boot, Lewandowski has come to value his young teammate's very sound mind above any other quality. Next year could prove to be an even more seismic one for Yamal, as reigning European champion Spain is one of the favorites to win the 2026 World Cup, with Yamal's measured maverick quality a trump card few nations can counter. It would be a title the teen's family has already anticipated. In the bakery run by Yamal's uncle, Abdul, back in Rocafonda, there is a replica of the most treasured award this sport has to offer. The real World Cup trophy may even find its way onto the bakery shelf. The next article is on NBA athlete Shai Gilgeous-Alexander. Much like the NBA championship team for which he stars, the Thunder's guard story in recent years has been one of steady ascension. A late lottery pick by the Clippers in 2018, he was dealt to the Oklahoma City as part of the Paul George trade in 19. With the Thunder, he grew from being the top scorer on a rebuilding team to being the MVP of both the league and the finals in 2025. And just as his franchise is the model for success in a post-super team NBA, so too has SGA become the prototypical star for the modern game. He's a young, 27, hungry athletic wing who can score, distribute, and play defense. The Thunder looked primed for a long run of title contention, so expect to see a great deal of him for years to come. The next article is written by Claire Brennan on Aitana Bonmati. She is simply the best player in women's soccer. Despite Spain falling to England in the UEFA Women's Euro 2025 final, the midfielder had a remarkable tourney, scoring an artful game winner in the semis against Germany weeks after being hospitalized with viral meningitis. The next article is on Cooper Flagg, an NBA superstar, written by Lorenzo Arguello. If anyone could live up to the hype of being the top hoops prodigy since LeBron James, it's the Flagg. The NBA's number one draft pick has both the game and the calm demeanor to make it work. The Mavericks rookie is also positioned to become the new face of New Balance's basketball line. The next athlete article is on college football star Arch Manning, written by Brian Fisher. He had thrown just 95 career passes coming into this season, but Arch Manning has gripped college football long before the latest Manning arrived on the 40 acres. As much as the QB wants to deflect the attention due to his last name, he is the sport's biggest draw this fall. Our next article is on athlete Shohei Ohtani, written by Stephanie Abstein. In 2024, the three-time MVP's first year with the Dodgers, the club added $70 million in sponsorship revenue due to his presence, says research firm Sponsor United, which notes he also made other teams $15 million from Japanese advertising at his road games. Next for athletes, we have an article written by Gray Whitebloom on Mohamed Salah. The division's most prolific lefty of all time was the steady metronome behind Liverpool's march to the 2024-25 Premier League title. He is a man of rare reach, with 65.8 million followers on Instagram. The Egypt native is the most followed soccer player from Africa. Next, we have golfer Scottie Scheffler. Not only did he snag two major titles this year to help extend a run at world's number one that began in May of 2023, but the 29-year-old upped his profile with a winning performance in Happy Gilmore 2, in which he pokes fun at his arrest during the 2024 PGA Championship. Our next athlete article is on Aja Wilson, written by Dan Falkenheim. In June, the three-time MVP and two-time champ became the fastest player in WNBA history to reach 5,000 points. A month earlier, she had another kind of achievement. Nike released the A1, the first time a company put out a signature shoe for a black woman in over two decades. We're now going to move on to an article on the Eagles offense. Consider this. Pushback. some defense, if you will, to the locker room adage, defense wins championship. The 2024 edition of the Eagles certainly featured plenty of aggressive tackling and forced turnovers, and the unit held its opponents to 17.2 points per game, second best in the NFL under the leadership of veteran coordinator Vic Fangio. But it was the action on the other side of the ball that catalyzed the franchise's Super Bowl season. The team featured a 2,000-yard rusher in Saquon Barkley, Jalen Hurts, a top-shelf quarterback entering his meaty prime, and a dynamic pair of receivers in A.J. Brown and Devontae Smith, who were as effective at blocking as they were at making big catches. At left tackle, they had Jordan Mailata, a former rugby player who was the most highly rated offensive player last year by Pro Football Focus. The Eagles, of course, also have a signature offensive play, the tush push, a maneuver so devastatingly effective that other teams have had to resort to lobbying unsuccessfully so far to ban it. This powerful offense is predicated on power, and it goes beyond the 6'8", 365-pound Mailata and best-in-league offensive line. Both Barkley and Hurts squat 600 pounds, a testament, yes, to their brute strength, but also symbolically a testament to their commitment. The offense is also undergirded by versatility. An opposing team with, say, a strong run defense might be able to thwart Barkley, but plenty of options remain. As Chiefs found out in Super Bowl 59, Kansas City held Barkley to 57 yards rushing on 25 carries, but the Chiefs were hardly celebrating that achievement after the Eagles scored 40 points and game MVP Hurts left had humbled them. Not surprisingly, the team's offensive coordinator, Kalen Moore, was poached to be the new head coach in New Orleans, but Moore's replacement, Kevin Petullo, has been with the Philadelphia offense in various capacities since 2021 and had an up-close view of what made the Eagles so effective. So did the rest of the league, and Philly's influence was apparent this spring. At the 2024 NFL Draft, the first running back was taken with the 46th pick. This year, four backs had been selected by that point, including Ashton Jeanty at number 6. It's still a quarterback's league, but ground attacks are officially back in vogue. No one needs to explain this to Philly, where, as the team tries to defend its championship, be assured, success rests on the offense. We're now going to move on to the essay, The Sky's the Limit, written by Pat Ford. The Loft is an event space at the Northern Quest Resort and Casino, which sits near the airport on the windswept edge of Spokane. To get to the Loft, you walk past smokers playing slots, hang a right at the Fatburger counter, and head upstairs. It's a boxy room with a bare floor, far more functional than opulent. And one night this summer, the Loft hosted a Big Sky Conference football dinner. The menu was on brand for the blue-collar Big Sky. Burgers, dogs, popcorn, and an open bar. Administrators, coaches, and players were free to grab a beer with their food, sit together at tables, and talk ball. There were cowboy boots and Stetsons and jeans. "This is who we are," said Conference Commissioner Tom Witzchill as he moved through the chow line. He's a round-faced man with a sense of humor and little pretense, which makes him a snug fit for an FCS league that rests on the fault line of the post-house settlement college sports world. The next morning, the Big Sky held its annual media day at the resort, promoting its 12 football program from 8 Western states. The day after that, the Big Ten began its media extravaganza at the massive Mandalay Bay in Las Vegas. The difference in size and grandeur between the two casinos is comparable to the difference between the two conferences, grit versus glitz. But if you want to gamble, you can do that every bit as well at Northern Quest as Mandalay Bay. And if you want to watch college football within a traditional, recognizable context, you can do that every bit as well in the Big Sky as in the Big Ten. We play the highest level of Division I sports, and we strike a balance between education, graduation, student-athlete experience, and the ability to compete, Wistrell says. We're really proud of that. We believe that we're doing college athletics the right way in the Big Sky. We're proud to wave that flag, and we'll fight for that. The fight is more complex than ever, as the league walks the line between modernizing and cherishing the old-school college model. The Big Sky is split exactly in half on opting into the House v. NCAA settlement that fundamentally altered college athletics, creating shared revenue for athletes and a higher number of scholarships, while also reducing many roster sizes. For schools at the FBS level, opting in was non-negotiable. For schools at the FCS level, where funding is tighter, it was a tougher choice, one that illustrates the current tension points for programs that could be considered tweeners on the D1 athletic scale. It was a striking split for a league of 12 public schools that was formed in 1963 and has enjoyed core stability for about 30 years. The six Big Sky schools that have opted in will distribute nothing close to the $20.5 million annual cap, maybe 1/20th of that, or 1/40th. The highest paid athletes in the league might well be distance runners from Northern Arizona, which has won 6 of the last 9 NCAA men's cross-country team championships. But for an aspirational conference, Wistrel and others would love to see all Big Sky members jump into the House poll by 2026. From a conference office staff of 12 people to the individual athletic departments, this is a try-harder league. Part of trying harder is getting everyone on the same rev share page and at least taking a swing at it. This is a league that celebrates its strong regional identity out west, especially with the Pac-12 diaspora being scattered to conferences across the map. But it also has compelling diversity, from the rugged beauty of Montana to the city schools in Portland and Sacramento to the high desert of Flagstaff, Arizona. And across that north-south bandwidth, they do support their football. The Big Sky operates at the high end of the FCS. The schools have smaller athletic budgets ranging from $18 million to $34 million in 2024 than most of their FBS brethren. They have less TV exposure, though 4 games will be on ESPN networks this season, up from 2 last year. Regardless of money, the top Big Sky programs play at a higher level than many FBS group of 6 conference members. 5 of its team earned bids to the 24-team FCS playoffs last year, with Montana State advancing to the championship before losing to North Dakota State. The Big Sky starts this season with 6 teams in the FCS coaches pool. Number 2, Montana State. Number 7, UC Davis. Number 9, Montana. Number 12, Idaho. Number 14, Sacramento State. And number 18, Northern Arizona. When it comes to fan backing, the league is surpassed by only the SWAC, and for those fans, halftime is often the main event. In the Big Sky, it's more a football purist pursuit. We have many places in our conference on a football Saturday where none of the fans would know who USC, Ohio State, or Alabama is even playing, Wistrel says. What they care about is what's happening with their local school. Last year, Montana was 2nd nationally in FCS average attendance at 24,174 fans per home game, a figure that ranks ahead of what 52 FBS programs averaged. Montana State was 3rd at 20,788, better than 41 FBS schools. I played at Texas. I played at Oklahoma, says Idaho State coach Cody Hawkins, who was a starting quarterback at Colorado from 2007 to 2010. There's no better place to play than Wash Grizz, Washington Grizzly Stadium at Montana. It's incredible there. Indeed, the Brawl of the Wild, as the Montana-Montana State rivalry is known, has taken on an Iron Bowl-level intensity. Annually played on the final Saturday of the regular season, the Bobcats versus Grizzly game, Cats versus Grizz for short, is constantly cussed and discussed in the Treasure State. It's one of those things where people talk about it for 364 days before it happens, and then it's bragging rights for the whole next year, says Bobcats defensive end Kenneth Eden IV. It's an identity. You're a Cat or a Grizz, and it shows every day. Adds Montana State coach Brent Vegan, it is the pinnacle of sports in our state. We have this in-conference, in-state rivalry, and we're really fortunate because a lot of those have gone away with conference realignment. That doesn't happen everywhere. What does happen everywhere, and perhaps more deleteriously here, is player poaching. Coaches in the league agree that the top-end talent is considerable, but there's just less of it. So the FBS schools come after the standouts. For my time in the Mountain West and the Pac-12, as an assistant at Boise State and Cal, I can tell you from starter to starter, Coach Bruce Barnum says, a tailback got bought. All my good ones are getting bought. You recruit all the time. Have to. It's just a different world, and it affects us differently than the big ones. Now we're their shopping ground. There is a resignation to the current system, but one of the problems that comes with playing guarantee games, a road game against the FBS program for a sizable check, is providing those opponents with scouting and recruiting access to their own players. They're shopping at our game at the game, says Barnum, who recalls a pregame episode from last year when he knew an opponent was interested in one of his players. I help the opposing coach out. I tell him, our kid's not ready. Let him get a little bigger before you buy him. Just get the F off my sideline. Beyond player retention, there is coach retention. Power Conference athletic directors are probably more open than ever to hiring coaches who have proven themselves at the FCS or lower levels, given the recent successes in the market by the likes of last season's Consensus National Coach of the Year, Indiana's Kurt Cignetti, who spent his first 11 years as a head coach at the Division II and FCS levels. Are there more coaches like that waiting for their shot? Yes. And the Big Sky would be a good place to look for them. Vegan has gone 47-10 at Montana State. Northern Arizona coach Brian Wright went an overachieving 8-5 in his first season. And Plow has a similar instant impact at UC Davis, going 11-3 and advancing to the FCS quarterfinals. There are great coaches, and usually most of the coaches are young, Plow says. They're guys that are getting started, and you're going to see them in the Power Four conferences soon. But they gotta be creative in this conference. There's not as many eyes on them, so they can try new things. As the high end of college football hurdles into more professionalized mode of operation, the Big Sky is a reminder that there is more than one way to play the game. There is still an educational component to the mission at this level, and there also is a deep fan fervor and intense competition. The league has something to sell without trying to pretend to be something it's not. The Big Sky is comfortable in its own boots and jean skin. Burgers and beers for everyone. You're listening to Sports Illustrated on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm your volunteer reader, Ben. Thanks again for listening. The next article I'll be covering is athlete-led media. The media ecosystem has changed rapidly over the last decade, with a fight for attention taking place thanks to the proliferation of platforms like TikTok. Perhaps no athletes have adapted to the current environment quite like Lynx players Natasha Heidman and Courtney Williams. The duo created a Twitch livestream called Stud Buds, which aired throughout the WNBA season and hit an apex with a 72-hour broadcast over All-Star Weekend, depicting a who's who of league stars partying while also documenting the mundane tasks of their everyday lives on their stream. The pair brought fans behind the scenes, lifting the curtain on the league like only the players could. Athletes telling their own stories has been a mounting trend since the emergence and expansion of social media. That movement has evolved to athletes starting their own content ventures. Together, a media and commerce company was founded in 2019 by two-time World Cup winner Alex Morgan, four-time WNBA championship Sue Bird, and Olympic gold medalist Simone Manuel and Chloe Kim. NBA star Kevin Durant co-founded Boardroom, a sports media and entertainment brand. In 2019, LeBron James founded Spring Hill Company, an entertainment development and production outfit. In 2020, the list goes on, and the catalog of Upstart's athlete podcasts is even longer. Host, analyst, and commentator were once roles reserved for retired athletes as the logical next step after playing careers. Now it's commonplace for the active professional athletes serving as marketing executives of their own brands to host a podcast or produce their own content. Travis Kalise chats weekly about the Chiefs season, among other topics like announcing girlfriend Taylor Swift's upcoming album, with his brother Jason on their podcast, New Heights. Jalen Brunson and Josh Hart of the Knicks co-host Roommate Show, a podcast that runs simultaneously with the NBA campaign. WNBA players Angel Reese and Cameron Brink, Alaya Boston, and Sophie Cunningham all have their own podcasts. These outlets allow athletes to control the narrative and offer real-time context to news items that would once have been filtered through traditional media channels. For younger leagues like the W, player-driven media also helps introduce the sports culture to the masses and build athlete celebrity. While the market is likely at a tipping point, oversaturated with swift influx of athlete podcasts, the balance of power has definitely shifted toward the players. This next article is on influencer Kylie Kalice. Like certain others with the last name of Kalice, Kylie has proved to be a natural behind the microphone. Her podcast, Not Gonna Lie, was an instant hit when it debuted last year, reaching number one on both Apple and Spotify. The show highlights her sense of humor and candor as she discusses such diverse topics as cheerleading, as a sport, and the realities of being a mother of four daughters. A proud Philly native and wife of ex-Eagles star Jason, Kalice has also expressed an interest in investing in women's sports in the city, saying, "Maybe call me," when the WNBA announced that an expansion team was coming to town in 2030. This next article is on John Boy Media, written by Will Laws. Baseball's most beloved media empire, fronted by James, John Boy, O'Brien, far left, and his co-host Jake Storali, has attracted countless fans through popular lip-reading videos of conversations happening on the diamond. The novel concept skyrocketed their YouTube channel to over 2 million followers and saw them branch out into podcasting and wiffle ball competitions with pro broadcasters. In June, MLB bought a minority stake in John Boy Media, which now has access to MLB's intellectual property while maintaining editorial control. The deal shows that John Boy's lighthearted yet intelligent cross-platform analysis is perhaps the best way for baseball to reach its long-held goal of building a younger fan base. Next, we have an article on College Game Day Crew. ESPN's ability to reshape its flagship college football show is a testament to the Saturday morning mainstay it has become. With centerpiece Lee Corso having bid farewell, new additions have brought a fresh flair. Say what you want about Pat McAfee. The former NFL punter brings out the best in campus crowds. He's flanked by the stoic Nick Saban, who goes viral as often for his reactions to McAfee's antics, as he does for his insights. Pairing them with veteran analysts Desmond Howard and Kirk Herbstreit, and the latter's golden retriever, Peter, makes for an electric group that still operates in harmony under the guidance of host Reese Davis. Next, we're going to move on to the executive section of the magazine, to an article on NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell, written by Albert Breer. In 20 years on the job, he's engineered the league's growth from popular sport into global cultural behemoth. How does NFL commissioner wield his power? According to those who have worked with him, there are many sides to his leadership style. The wound was open and fresh as Arthur Blank walked from the locker room, under scaffolding erected in the bowels of Houston's NRG Stadium, to a media area where his coaches and players would explain the most excruciating defeat any of them have ever suffered. The side of the Falcons owner's suit coat was still moist from having consoled general manager Thomas Dimitroff's tearful son. Then, from around the corner came Roger Goodell. Before they said a word to each other, the NFL commissioner wrapped Blank in a bear hug. Atlanta had just seen a 28-3 lead in Super Bowl 51 evaporate in a crushing loss to the Patriots. The leader of the most powerful sports league in North America didn't need to be told how the owner felt. "It's gonna be okay," Goodell told Blank. It was a rare, raw moment of empathy from the commissioner, who was then 11 seasons into the job. Many who have worked for the man, once nicknamed Ginger Hammer, and been on the wrong end of his temper, would be blown away to see him so vulnerable, feeling and even prioritizing the pain of others, and so soon after presenting the Lombardi Trophy to Patriots owner Robert Kraft. That was February 2017. Goodell is now 66 in his 20th season as commissioner. His two decades in charge have been complicated and challenging. He's handled a lockout, two collective bargaining agreements, landmark player discipline cases, a domestic violence crisis, and attacks from the most controversial president in American history. He staged a season through a pandemic and a social justice revolution. The scars of Goodell's early days of punishing Michael Vick and Pac-Man Jones remain. The metaphorical bloody knuckles from locking out the players are there, too. So what's the complete picture of his reign? It very much depends on who's painting it. The Blank encounter is juxtaposed against another side of Goodell. Many colleagues, adversaries, and associates casually refer to him as a bully. One well-respected decision-maker from a 2024 playoff team asserted it's even worse. "He's a silver spoon senator's son who thinks he's a bully, but he's really not." Goodell declined to be interviewed, and the NFL did not respond to requests for comment for this story. That most certainly was not what the owners were looking for in 2006. It was the opposite. Goodell's dad's connections did help get his foot in the door. Charles Goodell finished his term as a U.S. Senator from New York as Jack Kemp was elected to one of the state's congressional seats in 1970. More than a decade later, Kemp, an ex-Crow quarterback, put in a call recommending his fellow New Yorker's son for a position with the league. To be fair, Goodell made efforts of his own. After graduating from Washington and Jefferson with a degree in economics in 1981, he wrote letters to all 28 teams and did internships with the league's public relations office and with the Jets, including some coaching work under defensive coordinator Joe Gardy. In 1984, at 25, he became a full-time assistant in the NFL PR office. It quickly became clear to senior staffers that he had a knack for dealing with people. When the NFL was fighting the USFL for talent in the 1980s, Goodell was a voice of an 800 players' families could call about the differences between the leagues. He'd then be on the line to talk live if they had any questions after his recording. By the time Paul Tagliabue took the reins from the longtime commissioner Pete Rozelle in 1989, Goodell's potential was clear. His ambition was, too. Tagliabue elevated him to executive vice president of the league and football development and leaned on him to go into cities where teams were trying to get stadiums built. Perhaps the strongest mark Goodell made was in Cleveland. After Art Modell announced he was moving the team to Baltimore in 1995, Tagliabue would tell colleagues that Goodell took a dead balloon and blew it up in securing a stadium deal for the new Browns franchise. His timing was fortuitous. The NFL went through a construction boom. 15 of the 30 current stadiums opened between 1995 and 2003, including 11 in 5 years, 1998 to 2002, and Goodell was the center of it. According to those who knew him then, Goodell was protective of his duties, relentless as a dealmaker and intentional in using his position to build bonds with owners, relationships that would have then positioned him for his ultimate goal. The time came in 2006. The NFL generally picks commissioners for the era the league is in. Rozelle, who took over in 1960, was a public relations man with television expertise, capable of elevating the game that wasn't yet number one in America and overseeing the launch of franchises such as Monday Night Football. Tagliabue, an attorney, arrived as the NFL was smarting from two strikes, needing to modernize the CBA with true free agency on the horizon while keeping labor peace. By the time Tagliabue stepped aside, the NFL ownership guard had changed. Legacy families no longer were the majority. It was big money businessmen paying escalating prices for teams. They wanted a commissioner who could take the business of football to a new level. Kraft first saw Goodell's ability to do that in 1994, when Kraft bought the Patriots. Other league executives in the room deferred to Goodell, then in his mid-30s. Goodell was resolute. Kraft and his family were the right buyers to keep a wayward franchise in an essential Northeast market. By 2006, Kraft was one of Goodell's most strident backers. "There's no business like the NFL," Kraft says. "It's really complicated. I just thought the more I saw of him, the more he continued to grow. I wanted a strong internal person, so a few of us got together there and made sure it happened." In Goodell, they saw something reflecting their worldview in who would hand the reins back to them. "I really think this is the most important thing. He came in and we talked about an owner-operated mentality in the league's office," Kraft continues. "When we came in, they were more interested in what was good for the league's office and ownership." Goodell ran his campaign for commissioner with cunning deference to owners' desires. His chief competitor was NFL outside counsel Greg Levy. The first vote was 15-13 for Goodell, well short of the two-thirds majority needed. At that point, then-Dolphins owner Wayne Huizenga told the room that the NFL needed a generalist, not a specialist. To that end, Goodell asked league general counsel Jeff Pasch, who'd fallen out of the race, to be his right-hand man and cover his one hole, the lack of a law degree. On the fifth vote, Goodell won. The owner's commissioners was in place. A slew of suspensions and, in 2011, a lockout followed. Time dubbed Goodell the Enforcer on a 2012 cover. By then, he had lost the trust of players who saw him as a proxy for the hawkish owners. Vic and Jones were suspended for the entire 2007 season. Goodell's second in charge, conversely, Spygate, a story implicating Patriots coaches and execs, broke during the first week of that season. It led to monetary and draft pick penalties, but no bans of those coaches or execs. The double standard wasn't lost on the union. Quietly, though, Goodell did work to rehabilitate troubled players he'd suspended. Legendary coach Tony Dungy was paired with Vic before his re-entry in the NFL with the Eagles in 2009, and Goodell was in lockstep with the owners involved. To Rogers' credit, when Vic wanted to come back and play, the league created a pathway, says Blank, whose team had Vic for 6 seasons. When he went to Philadelphia, Jeff Lurie had a great coach there in Andy Reid. Michael went into a great environment that allowed him to play again and to be effective again, and eventually not only play at a high level, but he's living life at a high level now. There was no such soft touch in 2011. Goodell carried the owner's flag through the lockout. His chief adversary, the NFLPA chief, DeMarcus Smith, saw Goodell's resolve early. He said to co-workers, "Okay, it's war." The legal fight was never going to be Goodell's arena, and it was clear in those negotiations that Smith, Pash, and the NFLPA outside counsel, Jeffrey Kessler, had done the heavy lifting. Yet Goodell's keen understanding of leverage and when to exert it, which has shown repeatedly in broadcast negotiations, was a key to getting owners back to where they wanted to be, particularly with the revenue split after the perceived failures of 2006. Soon, though, the image problem the league carried because of its players would reflect on Goodell himself. He was the face of the bungled referee lockout in 2012, a charade over relative pennies, and created a massively embarrassing September for pro football, as he would later admit. He screwed up the front end of the NFL's domestic crisis of 14, issuing the Ravens' Ray Rice a 2-game suspension for punching his fiance in the face before video of the incident surfaced. The running back never played in the league again. Given the significant differences in sanctions imposed on teams, owners, front office people, coaches, and players, the idea that Goodell made decisions, in the words of one of his adversaries, with a finger in the wind, was prevalent. A nicer way of looking at it, he was a meat shield for owners, and his growing pains in handling them were significant and good for him in the long run. If Rice happens in 2000, it's not the story it became, says ex-colleague. The story becomes huge national news, and that's because the NFL was at a spot that was different than before. It hit all of us in the face, and through it, Roger became a good crisis leader. That was his formative crisis. Now, you can throw a lot of rocks at him, and he won't break. Goodell's concern for players also began to evolve. In 2015, Brandon Marshall and D'Angelo Williams approached him about building a platform for charities that mattered to individual players, which birthed My Cause, My Clients. Both had been fined in the past for uniform violations supporting causes important to them. Goodell was with Damar Hamlin and Ryan Shazier through catastrophic injuries and supported the Raiders' Carl Nassib when the defensive end came out in 2021. And according to friends, he viewed player safety as central to his legacy. One rival of Goodell says the commissioner's finest moment came amid the social justice uprising that followed George Floyd's murder in 2020, when he apologized to players for not listening to them for the league's slowness to support the movement. The impetus was not just a video prominent players shot imploring the league to act, but also Goodell listening to the leadership and the NFL's marketing team. Those close to Goodell would tell you that his ability to listen to those around him to synthesize varying opinions is one of his best qualities. Some at the NFL headquarters might not agree. A December 2014 Wall Street Journal story recounted a scene from the league office like this. Pizzas arrived, but no slice was taken until Mr. Goodell ate. He never did, and the slices turned cold in the box. The next day, the top guys at the union, as a joke, sent their staff a stack of pizzas. By then, it was common knowledge that 345 Park Avenue had become an emperor's palace. While accounts from the Midtown offices vary, there's little debate that it's a challenging place to work. To Goodell's loyalists, that's a sign of what one former colleague refers to as the commissioner's divine discontent, a belief that the NFL can never stand still. To those who've been on the wrong side of his temper, the descriptor for his leadership style would be less generous. Most on both sides believe the climate is that way intentionally. Goodell's way of making sure people never get comfortable. Goodell's corporate inner circle is crowded. Before NFL Chief Media and Business Officer Brian Rolapp became CEO of the PGA Tour in June, Goodell had 8 direct reports. Troy Vincent, Football Operations, Ted Olott, Pash's successor as General Counsel, Christine Dorfler, Fiance, Peter O'Reilly, Events International, Tim Ellis, Marketing, Dasha Smith, Human Resources, Jeff Miller, Government Public Affairs, and Rolapp. 2 execs who previously reported to Rolapp, EVP of Media Distribution, Han Schroeder, and EVP, Chief Revenue Officer, Renee Anderson, could move up now. Some owners believe that the list should shrink. It's not about anyone's qualifications. It's about the culture of the office and the future of it. When the commissioner and Jerry Jones were at odds over discipline handed down to Ezekiel Elliott in 2017, the Cowboys owners mused on whether the NFL needed to pay a Commissioner Goodell's widely reported salary of $64 million per year or $2 million per team, as one club president coached it. As the importance of media deals escalated, perception around the league grew that Rolap was emerging as a natural successor to Goodell. He then left, like so many before him. In 2015, Todd Lewicki became the NFL's first COO since Goodell. He resigned less than 3 years in. More recently, in 2022, Chris Halpin, once pegged as a potential replacement, departed for media and internet holding company IAC, all of which fuels a consensus that Goodell doesn't have interest in prepping his successor, lest the owners deem that person, who would undoubtedly come cheaper, ready for the job before the commissioner is ready to leave. Meanwhile, Huizenga's generalist candidate has lived up to the moniker by having his hand in every facet of the business. Goodell can be forceful on minutiae 1 minute. In football operation meetings, he'll sit in and survey the room, and then be heavy-handed on matters such as player fines and guide discussion on big-picture topics like international or broadcast the next. In some cases, it's brought out the best in him. A decade ago, fed up with Radio City Music's hall scheduling conflicts, the 2014 draft was moved to May because of Rocket's show. Goodell told New York staff, who wanted to keep it a home game, that the draft was moving, with or without them. It was out of necessity, to a degree, but also stemmed from his belief that the event wasn't being maximized. A decade later, cities bid to host it, and hundreds of thousands of fans attend. In 2027, it'll be on the National Mall in D.C. Another byproduct of Goodell's granular involvement is a vast curated network of power brokers across American industry. So unfolded a scene at the commissioner's tailgate in Houston at Super Bowl 51, where David Solomon, the CEO of Goldman Sachs, waited in line to talk with Goodell. "You'd have thought it should be the other way around," said one team president. Behind Solomon, in line, were top executives from Apple and Verizon. 6 years later, Amazon paid for the rights to the first Black Friday game, another innovation born of divine discontent. The number was significant. Soon thereafter, Amazon CEO Andy Jassy was the one calling Goodell to see how they could build on its momentum. Goodell was at Heathrow Airport in London in late October 2017 when a top aide's phone buzzed. It was the Texans, with a staffer calling to request that the commissioner back embattled owner Bob McNair at ESPN. Report had alleged that McNair said, "We can't have the inmates running the prison," during a summit with owners to discuss the Colin Kaepernick national anthem controversy. The aide was instructed to tell the Texans that Goodell was already in the air, flying back to New York. Seeing this non-confrontational version of Goodell would be surprising to some coworkers, but from that came a result you wouldn't have seen in 2006. Goodell standing on principle, refusing to tell the media that McNair had been taken out of context in the report, because he hadn't been. Goodell is still believed by many owners to play favorites with the owners like Kraft and Jones, yet the larger group has never been more solidly behind him. Much of it, of course, relates to the NFL closing in on Goodell's pie-in-the-sky goal of $25 billion in annual revenue, and the touch he's had for pulling all the right levers, even when faced with opposition among the owners, to get there. You look at 32 different owners in the meetings. I mean, pretty powerful, strong-willed individuals, Giants owner John Mara says. And you try to manage that and try to build a consensus among that group. I think that takes a unique skill set. There are very few people, if anybody, that could do it at that level. Goodell keeps a note card in his pocket listing the 31 owners and the publicly held Packers chief executive with the date that he last spoke to each jotted down. On Fridays, in a black car from Manhattan on his Westchester County home, he'll make calls to them, putting commute time to good use. The logic behind the practice, never have a less involved owner say, "Well, all you do is talk to Robert or Jerry." The result is relationships strong enough to withstand the most trying times. His bond with the Kraft survived Spygate and Deflategate. Jones, too, mostly backs Goodell, even when the issues he had with the commissioner's salary and his handling of discipline. "I didn't know that thing about the note card," Kraft says. "That's pretty smart. It's really tough. They're all different people, pretty big egos. He's been able to balance it pretty good. The result? Look at our ratings. Look at the health of the league. He's managed it very well, in my opinion." The league's place in American culture in 2025 makes that an understatement. One former coworker of the Goodells recalled a weekend trip with him, and the commissioner asking his driver to hit a Chick-fil-A drive-thru after a trying week at work. "I'm going to have some bad food," Goodell said, smiling. It was memorable only because he so seldom lets his hair down, even to those who know him well. Those sort of stories are scarce. He's said to be overly generous with those he's closest to. He cares deeply about his two daughters. His wife, former Fox News anchor Jane Skinner, is probably more protective of his image than he is. He's been very supportive, publicly and privately, of the LGBTQ plus community, at least in part because one of his brothers is gay. Otherwise, what he cares most about is the league he governs, which is why his grip isn't loosening much and no succession roadmap has been drawn. "I really thought he would move out of fifth gear a while ago, and he's still in fifth gear," Blank says. "That hasn't changed. No one contacted for this story thinks it will anytime soon. Goodell may be complex, he may be difficult, but to NFL owners, that's all been worth it for the work he's done, and presumably will keep doing for quite some time to come." This next article is going to be on athlete investors. Father time comes for us all, and for big-name athletes these days, that means thinking about second acts as owners, founders, and investors in other ventures, often before their playing days are even over. Serena Williams, who became a minority stakeholder in the Dolphins in 2009, now has her own makeup line, Win Beauty, as well as ownership interest in NWSL's Angel City FC and the WNBA's expansion Toronto Tempo. Stephen Curry launched his own line of bourbon, while Dwayne Wade co-owns a wine company. LeBron James has minority stakes in Liverpool and the Red Sox, while fellow GOAT Tom Brady is part of the ownership groups of Birmingham City FC and Las Vegas Raiders and Aces. And the player in hottest pursuit of Brady's football GOAT status, Patrick Mahomes, has years left in his NFL career, yet is already putting his money in the Royals, both Kansas City pro soccer clubs, and an F1 team, a KC steakhouse, and plenty more. Add in all other media pursuits, and there's a good chance our millennial sports stars won't ever lose our attention in retirement. The next article is on Kirsty Coventry. The five-time Olympian is the mold-breaking 10th president of the International Olympic Committee after 131 years of men holding the office. A favorite of outgoing President Thomas Bach, she won election on the first ballot over six men in March. The 42-year-old Zimbabwean is also the first African leader of the IOC and the most accomplished athlete to pilot the organization. Coventry won seven Olympic medals, two gold, and once held world records in the 100 and 200 meter backstroke. She also led Auburn to three NCAA titles. She said that her election was a signal we're truly global and that we have evolved into an organization that is truly open to diversity. But she has backed a blanket ban on transgender participation in female Olympic sports. Our next article is on mega boosters. Everything really is bigger in Texas, including the checks that wealthy donors write to support their favorite athletic programs. At Texas Tech, Regent and former offensive lineman Cody Campbell has spearheaded the Red Raiders' surge in NIL payments in a bid to compete for a Big 12 title and college football playoff berth. At SMU, a group of oil execs and businessmen, led by billionaire alum David Miller, donated more than $200 million to secure the school's move from the AAC to the ACC in 2024, which was dependent upon the Mustangs forfeiting league broadcast revenue shares for 9 years. But this isn't just a Lone Star spending spree. Athletic departments around the country are tapping into their deepest pockets to fund the new $20.5 million annual revenue share for athletes. Boosters are helping procure players, but are they also buying additional influence when it comes to hiring and firing coaches? Time will tell. Our next article is on Gino Arima. The winningest coach in Division I college basketball history is still on top of his game. Arima added yet another trophy to the case at UConn with his 12th national championship back in April, and he's poised to contend for another this season. The 71-year-old has spent more than half of his life courtside in stores, but he's been nimble enough to adapt to the art of recruiting and retaining players in the modern age. As his sport has boomed around him, he remains as central a figure as ever. Our next article is on David Beckham, written by Tom Gott. It spoke volumes about Sir David that his knighthood in 2025 was not just for services to sport, but also for his philanthropy. The six-time Premier League winner once donated his entire salary from his time with Paris Saint-Germain to charity, and he is a major supporter of Malaria No More UK, which aims to end the disease globally. Beckham has also worked with UNICEF for 20 years as a goodwill ambassador. In 2015, he started his Seven Fund with that organization, focusing on issues impacting girls. And he is an ambassador for the King's Foundation, using his status to help children across the globe. While doing so much away from soccer, Beckham has remained active in the sport in which he made his name. A co-owner of Inter Miami, Beckham also has linked up with several of his former teammates in the boardroom of Manchester-based Salford City, ramping up his stake in the club in a bid to give back to the community in which his career began. Our next article is on professional golfer Rory McIlroy. After 11 years of chasing a career Grand Slam, for which he lacked only the elusive green jacket, the 36-year-old finally earned his Masters win in April. McIlroy joined Gene Sarazen, Ben Hogan, and Gary Player, Jack Nicklaus, and Tiger Woods as the only players to win all four golf majors. It's not just McIlroy's on-course actions that draw headlines, but also his outspoken nature. Though he skipped media obligations at some events this year, when he does speak, the Northern Irishman doesn't mince words. He's honest about his own play, has chastised Murrayfield Golf Club for barring women, and led the charge as one of the fiercest critics of the Saudi-backed LIV Golf during that rival league's early days. It's why there's a distinctive buzz when he tees up, as he draws the biggest galleries in the game. It's all part of what makes him Rory. No last name needed, just like Tiger, Jack, and Arnie before him. Our next article is on LeBron James. Cross turning 40 off the list of things that could slow down King James. He's earned all NBA second team honors in his first season as a quad generation, finishing 6th in MVP voting, and he was the NBA's most viewed player on digital and social media, generating 3.23 billion views, about 25% more than second place Stephen Curry. James has ceded some power in LA with Luka Doncic, now the Lakers' future, but he has a big flex in his pocket. If the team struggles and he hits the market, James, armed with a no-trade clause, could handpick his destination and reshape the NBA playoff field. That was the last article for this week's Sports Illustrated program. This is your Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer broadcaster, Ben. Thank you so much for listening and have a great week. We'll see you next time on Sun Sounds of Arizona.